Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Climate change is accelerating quite fast, actually, now.
Code red for humanity, that blistering warning from the UN. Climate change is widespread, intensifying, and caused by us. Then, what can we do? I'll speak to the landscape architect using nature to help shield our coastal cities. Plus,
if we end up having to check an inbox or chat once every 6 minutes, which is actually just about average right now, our brains basically melt down.
A world without email? Author and professor Cal Newport wants freedom from the tyranny of the inbox. And finally,
truth is a new minority. Welcome to me.
Prince's prophetic album. I ask his close friend, Van Jones, why release it now? And what does it say a decade after recording? Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Global warming is happening faster than we previously thought. No corner of the earth is unaffected, and we are to blame. That is from the UN in a landmark report with strong words from Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The alarm bells are deafening and the evidence is irrefutable. Greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel burning and deforestation are choking our planet and putting billions of people at immediate risk. And even if we wanted to ignore it, we cannot. Wildfires are raging right now in California and Siberia. Apocalyptic scenes in Greece with thousands of people forced to flee burning infernos. Also this summer, a deadly heat wave in Canada. Fatal floods in Germany and China. Drought in central Brazil. These extreme weather events have been intensifying for years. The next, and some say the last chance to get the world to pay attention and to keep to their commitments will come at the UN Climate Summit in November. Alok Sharma will host the COP26 in Glasgow, Scotland, and it will be led, as I said, by the climate chief and president, who's joining me now in London. Alok Sharma, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us on this pretty, I mean, let me say it, apocalyptic day and really quite terrifying warnings. I guess I just want to ask you, do you agree first with the dire warnings from the IPCC? And do you think we're heading into the catastrophe that they are predicting?
Well, thank you very much for having me on the program. The report that the IPCC has put out is obviously hugely comprehensive, and it is based on the science. And the science is very clear, exactly as you've said in your introduction. It is humanity which is responsible for the climate change that we're seeing around the world. What the report does conclude that there is still a window open, the door is still slightly ajar in terms of us taking the actions to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. But I'm afraid that door is going to close pretty soon unless we take action now. And that's why, as part of the work that my team and I are doing on COP26, we are asking every country to come forward with ambitious emissions reduction targets and also then follow that through with action as well.
So that's where it gets, you know, where the sort of rubber meets the road, doesn't it? There's promises and there's action. I spoke to John Kerry, former Secretary of State, now climate czar under the Biden administration. He obviously, as you know, organized the US part of the COP25 in Paris. This is what he said to me about promises. Let's just listen.
We're not on a track. Even if we did everything that we promised to do, all of us in Paris, we still would have a rise in the Earth's temperature that is unacceptable, somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5 degrees. That's catastrophic. So we obviously have to accelerate. And the Paris Agreement contemplated that countries would come together several years down the road and make a judgment about where we are and then raise ambition. So Glasgow is definitively about raising ambition.
So, Alok Sharma, you know, it was there, it laid it out, all these countries, you know, 196 or so signed on. Now you have to corral them into actually meeting these promises. And I guess that's where many of us, you know, we sort of despair if you can't get you know, China and India, who still believe in coal, or Russia and Australia and Saudi Arabia and all the rest of it, who are busy pouring out fossil fuels. What is it that you can say to them at this point to get them to meet these promises and pledges for basic, you know, human survival?
Well, Glasgow, of course, is about raising the ambition bar, and it's the first piece in the ratchet mechanism that was set in place in the Paris Agreement. Now, if you look, Christian, when the UK took on the COP26 presidency, less than 30% of the global economy was covered by a net zero commitment. We're now at 70%. So that is progress, but of course we need all countries to step forward with that net zero commitment by the middle of the century. If you look at the G7 nations, for the first time ever, we have every G7 country with ambitious plans to cut emissions by 2030 on a trajectory to net zero by 2050. That is progress, but of course, you're right, we need every country to come forward, particularly those G20 nations that have not yet come forward with more ambitious plans to cut emissions. And that's what we're doing right now, is talking to them. I can tell you from the conversations that I'm having is that every country does recognize that climate change is not just real, but is affecting their populations as well. And there is a very clear understanding that climate change doesn't recognize borders. And that's why they all need to step up. We've, of course, before COP26, we've got the UN General Assembly in September. We've got the G20 leaders event taking place in October. Those are, again, occasions where countries that have not yet come forward with ambitious commitments to step forward and to do so. And indeed, what's also going to be really important as part of this is to support developing nations as well. Back in 2009, developed countries made a commitment that from 2020 to 2025, every year, $100 billion would be mobilized to support developing economies. We're not there yet. We've seen some new financing money that has come forward at the end of the G7 leaders meeting from Germany, from Canada, from Japan. But we need every G7 nation, we need all the donors to come forward and step up so that we can provide support for developing countries as they look to make clean energy transition and indeed to adapt the climate change that we're already seeing around the world.
So look, there are two issues there that I'd like to bring up. One is climate change, by and large, does not happen just by itself. This is the first major report that said unequivocally it's happening because of us. So you say all countries, presumably yours as well, presumably the UK. And we know that there are plans now to tap a new oil field off Shetland. And the British government also says more oil and gas wells will be drilled or can be drilled in the North Sea, and plans for a new coal mine in Cumbria. It doesn't make sense.
Well, just to say, if you look at the UK, I think I can tell you from the conversations that I have with governments and parties around the world is that the UK is recognised as a country which has been able to demonstrate green growth. Over the last 30 years, we have grown our economy by almost 80% and yet cut emissions by over 40%. I was just talking to you about the G20 nations. It's important they all step forward. But if you look, since the year 2000, the UK economy has been the fastest at decarbonising of all the G20 nations. So, of course, it's important for us to lead. We've been showing that. And specifically on the issues you've raised about coal mines, what I would say to you is that there is, of course, a public inquiry that's going to take place in that, and people will have a chance to set out their views. But on the broader issue of coal, we have effectively almost eliminated coal from our electricity mix, and we have gone from around 40% of our electricity coming from coal power just in 2012 to less than 2% now, and we will have no more coal in our electricity mix from 2024. The reason, Christian, we've been able to do this is because we have built the largest offshore wind sector in the world, which we are looking to quadruple. And I think just to address your issue on oil and gas, I think you were making reference to the Cambo oil field. This is an existing license, and there has been a public consultation. We'll see what the Oil and Gas Authority come forward with. But in terms of any future licensing, we have been very clear as a government that there will be a climate compatibility checkpoint. We will ensure that any future licenses are judged against our legal commitment that we will be net zero by 2050 in our economy.
You know, obviously, you know very well, Michael Mann, he was one of the lead authors of the 2001 IPCC report. He said today, bottom line is that we have 0 years left to avoid dangerous climate change because it's here. And what I don't fully understand is that our civilization has shown itself able to adapt to so many challenges since the industrial age before and since. What is it that, let's say, fossil fuel giants or the others don't get about the fact that it could be a massive economic boom to go into green technology and all the other things that would hopefully try to save us from this catastrophe that we seem to be barreling towards? Where is the failure, either from government, which has to hold them to account, or any other areas to get them to rethink their economies?
Well, actually, I mean, I think we are at an inflection point where you are hearing the same message from many governments, businesses and civil society around the world, that we have to tackle climate change now. And when I talk to the business community around the world, they do understand that actually investing in green growth is a huge investment opportunity. In fact, investing in the green industrial revolution is the biggest investment opportunity since the original industrial revolution. That is very clearly understood. We are, with the UN, working on a campaign called Race to Zero, where non-state actors, many of them businesses, are committing to go to net zero by 2050. There is a big move in that direction. We're also ensuring that we get the private sector finance commitments as well. So we have a campaign called GFANZ, which is the Global Financial Alliance for Net Zero, the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero. We've got over $80 trillion worth of assets that have committed to go to net zero by 2050. So there is this realization. In terms of the move to a clean energy transition, you are seeing that across the world. We needed to accelerate. I mean, let's take coal as an example, because you raised that in earlier on in this conversation. The reality is that private sector investors are increasingly wary about investing in coal assets, in coal power plants, because they can see that on a 10, 15-year view, they're going to end up with stranded assets. So the market is moving, but of course what we need to do is to help countries, particularly developing nations, to accelerate a lot faster in terms of their clean energy transition.
So in your diplomacy that you're having right now with, you know, China, India and all the others, do you have any hope, realistic hope, that they will do what they need? They are committed to coal. They're building new coal plants. They don't seem to be really pulling back like they need to, and they're major polluters.
Well, I think in terms of China first, President Xi Jinping has committed that China will be net zero by 2060, that the emissions peaking will come by 2030. I think if you look at some of the analysis that's out there, it suggests that China is likely to peak emissions before 2030. And when it comes to the issue of coal, you may well have seen back in May that the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, which I think by assets is the largest bank in the world, has said that they're looking at a roadmap to pull out of international coal financing. So you are seeing moves, but China, as with every other country, it's important that there are those top line commitments, but we also need to see the detailed policy that goes with it, and that's what I am pressing colleagues in Beijing on. In terms of India, India's made a big commitment in terms of 450 gigawatts of renewables by 2030. I mean, that really is a big commitment. Of course, what we want to see is that those policy commitments are reflected in the emission reduction targets that they set out.
Well, you have your work cut out for us and for all of us. Alok Sharma, thank you very much indeed for joining us tonight. Rising sea levels will put our coastal towns and cities and communities at serious risk as well. Just last week, experts warned that Lagos in Nigeria, home to 24 million people, could be unlivable by the end of the century thanks to extreme flooding and rising waters. So What is the solution? Kate Orff is a landscape architect trying to find one. She told The New Yorker, we have to hit the reset button if we want nature to come back. There's no more natural nature. Now, it's a matter of design, she says. So, what does she mean? We're going to ask her. Kate Orff joins me from New York, and welcome to the program. Kate Orff, those seem to be pretty difficult sentences to understand and internalize. There's no more natural nature. What does that mean?
Well, I guess in this last century, when we've built an economy based on the extraction of fossil fuels and the decimation of our natural landscapes, we're facing now a climate-changed future with more fires, more intense storms, rising sea levels, riverine flooding. And we've also, at that same time, lost this sort of protective benefit of the wetlands, forests, coral reefs, oyster reefs, mangroves, all of these systems that once protected us. So in my view, and I'm really in the adaptation space here, in my view, it's really time for a broad investment in the natural systems and the landscapes that can sustain us and anticipate these risks of the future.
And of course, living in Manhattan, in the New York area, you're living on very low-lying territory there. And you have designed a whole sort of ecosystem around Staten Island, so living breakwaters. And you've kindly provided us some pictures. So I'm going to ask you to walk us through what looks like a really interesting project. So what is it? You've designed reef streets to be submerged. Tell us about this first picture.
Right. Well, you know, as your viewers probably will remember, the New York region, New York, New Jersey region, was hit incredibly hard by Superstorm Sandy in 2012. And so this project, Living Breakwaters, was a kind of an investment in innovative infrastructure. How can we just not build back as we were before, but how can we look to the future and anticipate the landscapes that we need for the whole, you know, litany of risks that we'll be facing. So the Living Breakwaters Project, which is in Raritan Bay and just off the shore of Tottenville, Staten Island, is essentially a half-mile linear necklace of breakwaters, nearshore breakwaters, that are constructed from a combination of concrete and ecological units. And what they do is they calm the water, they sort of rebuild onshore beaches, they reduce erosion, and they kind of bring back that protective layered ecosystem of reefs and beaches that once really characterized the coastal protection of our region. But more than just that physical project, though, the Breakwaters Project is also an ecological pilot of reviving the historic ecosystems that once characterized our region. Robust fish, a mosaic of fish habitat, a mosaic of underwater habitat and oyster reefs that really kind of help to clean and calm the water here. And it's also a social project or a community building project, if you will, that involves citizen science, that involves sort of oyster education, science-based education. So it's really a combination of, you know, physical risk reduction in the breakwaters, but really thinking about rebuilding this ecosystem that we've lost and integrating people into the process. And so it's really trying to look in a forward-looking and holistic way about what do we need to be doing to adapt to our changing climate in the next decades.
And about this one, you've said it can mitigate surges during storms. But also, you know, I think inquiring minds want to know, why oysters?
Well, why oysters is a great question. First of all, I see oysters as first our sort of environmental engineering partners. Oysters can clean and filter the water. They can kind of agglomerate on these breakwater structures and help reduce the wave action and slow the water. But just to be very clear, you know, a big part of climate adaptation is motivating people to act. You know, your first guest and in your first segment, we're talking about the emotions that we feel after reading this IPCC report. I mean, these emotions range from fear and sadness and frustration, but one emotion that I refuse to dig into is despair, because we have created these challenges, but we have the imagination and we have the will to break through these challenges. So, in short, the oysters component of this project and the sort of active seeding of the reef and the outreach to school children, the science-based education, this is really a tool for community engagement and for participation, and really as a way to kind of bring people into a larger discussion about the risks in their immediate environment and, frankly, the pleasures and that the future program of and a vision that to kind of bring people together to make change in their immediate neighborhood and their environment.
So actually, you brought up the notion of hope, and I wanted to read this quote that I might have played to my last guest, but I didn't. It's from Dr. Kate Marvel, who's a climate scientist at NASA. She says, as a climate scientist, I'd like you to know, I don't have hope. I have something better, certainty. We know exactly what's causing climate change. We can absolutely, one, avoid the worst, and two, build a better world in the process. So that is really something important to focus on a day like this with that terrible report that's just come out. What, you know, you also work and have colleagues in the same business, if you like, the same efforts around the world. What are you seeing that's being translated from your landscape architecture in this regard, perhaps around the world?
Yeah, well, I see this not only just the reef system that I just described as being something that's replicable, but it's really this entire idea of community engagement, ecological rebuilding, and investment in nature-based infrastructure and risk reduction. It's that combination of elements that I see to be highly replicable around the world. And I also teach urban design at Columbia University, and Kate Marvel is my colleague there. But what I've seen around in global cities around the world is that this kind of sort of combination of factors could be applied in so many places to bring people a greater awareness of global cities, climate change, and the impacts of that we will be anticipating and what we are seeing now. For example, in Calcutta, you know, a mega city in India, that is experiencing or now and is slated to experience kind of extreme inundation. You could imagine mangrove replanting in the Sundarbans wetlands. In Vietnam, in places around the world, you can imagine an infrastructure which is really driven by ecology and people kind of coming to the foreground and really helping people understand the risk, adapt to the risk, and sort of have a role in sort of mitigating that risk for their communities.
And closer to home, of course, is really relevant now and all times. You know, communities of color are disproportionately affected by the worst aspects of climate change, certainly in the United States and elsewhere. And you have a project about bridging divides. We have two beautiful pictures, and I want you to talk me through them. But you raised this question. Can we do with landscape what we cannot do with political ideology or the internet? Can we mend things ecologically and also repair the social world? You obviously think yes. Tell us how.
Well, it's a tall order, but I think we have to try. So we have a project in the Atlanta metro region called the Chattahoochee Riverlands, and it's a 100 linear mile blue way and green way that is advancing kind of non-motorized transit that's really investing in river access and communities of color and places that have been traditionally underserved by investment and infrastructure. We're also helping to rebuild the sort of shoreline and riverine ecologies along the Chattahoochee. And it's just a project that is, I think it's a project that kind of talks to the future and the investments in infrastructure that we need to be making in the American context. We have a bipartisan infrastructure bill being discussed right now. Let's not spend our money on just widening highways. Let's think about the projects that will connect us literally, physically, like in the case of the Chattahoochee Riverlands, through bikeways and greenways that will help rebuild our ecosystems. And another example is a project in Memphis called Tom Lee Park, which is just one 30-acre stretch of parklands near downtown Memphis. But it's really conceived of as part of a network of parks that kind of knit the city back together and sort of hit the reset button on its relationship with the Mississippi River. These are the kinds of projects that are not going to solve climate change. We truly need to decarbonize our economy to hit that. But as we see from IPCC, the warming and the changes are baked in, so we must adapt. So let's adapt and have a very forward-looking visionary stance, and let's think about rebuilding our community infrastructure, rebuild our communities, and rebuild the ecosystems that have sustained us for so long. It's time to do that now.
So do you think then that New Yorker article, which called one of your oyster ideas hokey at the time, that you're having the last laugh or the last piece of, climate responsibility?
Well, as I said in the New Yorker piece, it certainly was motivating in 2010 to have the initiative dismissed like that. But my response was like, this is already happening, that there is a community upwelling and a community uprising in terms of a desire to reconnect with our water bodies, to develop in a more sustainable and resilient way, to integrate the restoration of our waterways and our environment. So I found that comment to be very motivating, but we're going into construction for the Living Breakwaters project in 2 weeks. So I feel like having that groundbreaking or water breaking in 2 weeks' time, I will feel very satisfied.
Vindicated. And it was my mistake. It was a New York Times critic who said it, not the New Yorker. Kate Orff, thank you so much and good luck. Now, how many emails have you received today? And are you on multiple WhatsApp groups? Do you feel sometimes like your brain is in meltdown, trying to cope with it all? Our next guest wants us to radically change the way we communicate in the workplace. Author Cal Newport takes Hari Srinivasan on a journey now through a world without email.
Christian, thanks. Cal Newport, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Let's start with a big basic question. A world without email, why?
Well, I'm using a shorthand when I say a world without email. What I really mean is a world without the style of collaboration that email made possible, which I call the hyperactive hive mind, and is an approach to work in which we figure most things out on the fly with back and forth ad hoc messaging. My argument is that this approach to collaboration has been both a productivity disaster, but also a psychological disaster for knowledge workers.
Okay, let's break that down a little bit. The productivity disaster part, why?
So if we're working most things out ad hoc on the fly with messaging, what happens is we end up with many different asynchronous back and forth conversations happening at the same time. We cannot let them linger too much. If we delay too long answering one of these conversations, things get slowed down. So we have to check inboxes or Slack or Teams or whatever tool we're using to communicate. We have to check it all the time. That's a disaster because our brains can't context switch that much. If we end up having to check an inbox or chat once every 6 minutes, which is actually just about average right now, our brains basically melt down. It takes us 10 or 15 minutes in reality to completely change our focus from one thing to another. So it puts us in this persistent state of self-imposed reduced cognitive capacity. We're quite literally making ourselves dumber accidentally by working this way.
What is good and what is bad about sort of collaborative problem solving? And why is it twisted in this way, where what is negative about the hyperactive hive mind?
It's the unscheduled nature of the communication. So let's say, for example, which is typical, I have something like 24 different back and forth asynchronous interactions happening via email. Over here, we're trying to schedule a meeting for a client. Over here, we're trying to edit a deck. Over here, we're trying to figure out a new strategy theme or something like this. Each one of these has messages coming back and forth unscheduled. I sent the message. At some point, someone will respond to it. I can't really ignore these messages, right? Because we have to figure out the client meeting date by the end of the day because he's coming tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
So I have to keep checking these inboxes to wait for the next message to come in so I can send it back. Now, if we scale this over 24 different conversations, now I constantly have to scale it. If you want to do, let's say, collaboration with a group on something, put aside time, get the people together and do group collaboration. That's fantastic. You'll get a lot done, but it's scheduled, right? You know when that work is happening and you're giving it your full attention when you can. The thing we have to avoid is the need to always be checking, because we never know when that next message is going to come. But when it does, we have to answer it right away.
Is some of this action and reaction that we take in the workplace, reply, reply all, performative? I mean, are we doing this because we think it's sort of like the equivalent of making sure the boss sees that I'm working?
There's a performative aspect to the hyperactive hive mind. If this is the main way work happens, it opens the door to the sort of performative signaling of productivity, which comes with, I think, lots of issues. But one thing I like to emphasize is that it's not entirely performative, because sometimes I'll get the reaction to this that says, no, if we could just change the norms, if we could get people to have better expectations, if we could get people to send smarter emails, we'd be fine. My argument is we cannot solve this problem by repairing our relationship to our inboxes. We actually have to stop those inboxes from getting so full in the first place. And that means changing underlying processes. We don't just send emails to schedule client meetings. We use this system. We don't just rock and roll on Slack when we're trying to come up with a new theme for our marketing campaign. It's Monday mornings from 9 to 9:30, and we do it in this conference room, and it's highly structured, and you have to write the memo the weekend before so we can all read it. We have to actually replace the hive mind with specific alternatives.
This is a multi-billion dollar industry trying to figure out how to get offices to communicate efficiently. You've got so many different players in it, right? You've got Microsoft, the people who made email ubiquitous through their Office application. You've got Slack, which is a kind of an instant messaging. Microsoft has Teams. There's so many different ways to do it. What are they getting wrong? What are they missing? Because they seem to be going after email, saying, well, email wasn't so efficient, but chatting, almost like texting back and forth, is. Does that solve anything?
Well, here's what happened. So we fell into this hyperactive hive mind workflow basically by default. Once we started working this way, we realized there's shortcomings with email as a tool if the way we're going to collaborate is back and forth ad hoc messages. So we invented new tools like Slack, like Teams, that basically implemented the hyperactive hive mind better. I think that's why people have a love-hate relationship with these tools. On the one hand, if this is the way you're going to collaborate, it's a smoother tool for doing so. On the other hand, we hate this way of collaborating. So I think a lot of our focus right now has been, okay, I guess we'll just stipulate that this constant back and forth ad hoc messaging is how we're going to work. And once we stipulate that, then we can say what's the best tool to use. And sure, Slack is probably better than an old email client if that's what you're going to do. But my argument is that that way of collaboration itself is causing a lot of trouble. We need to think much bigger, not how do we do this faster, but how do we replace this whole way of collaborating altogether?
Yeah, this conversation is more relevant today because we are facing the potential of a remote working environment being extended out into longer futures, depending on the industry, depending on what city you work in, depending on what kind of company you work in. People are rethinking, well, what is the best way for an employee to work? And then what are the tools that can make that happen? Well, ultimately, there have been many people who've researched what the mix should be. What did you find when you were writing this book?
Well, something that became clear is that the hyperactive hive mind is not very compatible with fully remote work. That if you look at knowledge sector companies that are relatively successful with remote work, what you tend to find, the unifying factor, is they have much more structured approaches to how they collaborate, how they keep track of who is working on what, how they communicate about the work, how much work do you think anyone should have on their plate at the same time. In the absence of that structure, when everyone is remote and everything now is just abstractions, you're just a Slack handle or email address and communication is just flying back and forth and Zoom invites are just flying back and forth, things spiral out of control. And I think a lot of people experienced that over the last year and a half. A lot of knowledge workers found themselves in back-to-back-to-back-to-back Zoom, trying to do email and Teams chats simultaneously, getting basically no actual work done. Remote work requires structure. I think there's no way around that.
So give me an example of some good behaviors that and good structures and infrastructures that companies have put into place. What should we be doing to try to not just maximize productivity, but, you know, just be sane and humane with each other?
Well, one example of a sector within knowledge work that has traditionally had a lot of success with remote work, for example, is software development. And why is this? Because they have already put in place usually pretty structured modes of collaboration. Most of these shops are using what are known as agile project management methodologies. They have a shared board where every task is listed. You know who is working on what. They have a highly structured morning meeting where all of the communication about the work happens. They actually care about how much stuff is on your plate at the same time. This is an example of a type of work in which they could go remote or not remote without much issues. Another example I found in my research are these so-called ROWE companies, R-O-W-E, which stands for results-only work environment. And these are companies that have really changed their culture so that it's results-oriented. When you work, where you work, how you work is made less important. You just clearly identify, here's what I'm working on, here's when I'm going to get it done, here's when we need to communicate to get that done. These highly structured environments also don't have the same issues of constant email overflow. And during the pandemic, they went remote and back and remote with basically no issue at all.
You talk a little bit in the book and in other places about deep work. What does deep work mean? And what do we need to do to create an environment for ourselves where we can execute that way?
So deep work is where you're able to focus on something that is cognitively demanding without context shifting. So you can give it your full attention without having to check an inbox every 5 minutes, without having to look at Slack, without having to glance at your phone. When you're in a state of deep work, where you're actually giving something your full unbroken concentration, you get a lot more out of your brain than when you're not, when you're half attention, when you're context shifting. And one of the arguments I made in the book I wrote about deep work, it was eponymously called Deep Work, is that this is an incredibly valuable activity, especially in the knowledge economy. We should be prioritizing and supporting it, but we don't, and it's almost impossible. And why is it impossible? Because the hyperactive hive mind demands that we constantly check all these inboxes.
You know, when you talk about deep work, I want to ask if that's something that is a luxury. You know, I remember reading about a long time ago, Marc Andreessen said that he would only check email twice a day. I'm like, wow, that must be nice. I mean, you're the CEO, you're the boss of, at the time, Netscape, right? You can afford to do that. But all of your subordinates, the people who report to you, they can't afford to do that. Or if I'm the end level, lowest level guy, a person in an organization, I can't afford not to be on email because my boss might ask me something, right? Or some other colleague might.
So let's say you're in an administrative assistant style support role. Well, you're not going to be spending 4 hours at a time working on one thing. Your tasks are going to tend to be smaller, but we would like to set things up so you could do one thing at a time and not have to be constantly servicing Slack and email and switching your context back and forth. Now, let's say you're a computer programmer. The one thing you're doing at a time might be writing a tricky algorithm. So to do one thing at a time might mean hours of work in a row before you move on to something else. And so those durations differ depending on the job. But regardless of the job, I think human neuroscience is pretty clear. Humans do best when they do one thing at a time.
Is there something changing about how we perceive our relationship to work? I mean, for a lot of people, the pandemic force them to see the things that they had compromised and sacrificed in order to go to the office. And all of a sudden having perhaps, this is again, white collar workers who are privileged enough to take this time to do this, they were starting to reflect on, well, why am I doing this? And we have also kind of a generational difference here in how younger people perceive their relationship to work than older people.
I think there's definitely a disruption occurring. I think definitely the pandemic is pushing it. When you look at these sort of knowledge workers, I would call them like generically educated knowledge workers. So workers that can do many different types of jobs, not someone who is trained in one very specific skill. We're seeing both a shuffling and a downsizing seems to be happening. The shuffling is people changing locations and jobs, maybe even just for novelty or variety. And the downsizing is people actually literally reducing the footprint of paid employment in their life. Maybe if I live somewhere cheaper, I don't have to work as hard of a job. I think knowledge work in particular is really susceptible to these type of disruptions because unlike other types of labor, it's very ambiguous. You know, we're in an office and there's a computer and we're doing email all day and it's actually kind of hard to point at sometimes. I made that, or I helped produce this, or here's the locomotive that my team turned off of the Baldwin assembly line. In the absence of that, it's sort of a weird almost half simulacrum of work. It can feel that way sometimes, just a flurry of Slack and PowerPoint. And because it's so ambiguous, it's really ripe for disruption when something changes and knocks us out of our cultural conventions about work. And we say, well, how much of this do I want to do? How much of my life do I want to spend hitting, you know, enter in my Slack chat box? What do I really do for a job here? I think a lot of this reflection is happening. And I think a lot of this is happening in part because we have not yet done the hard work and knowledge work of actually getting better at defining work, having good metrics, structuring work, making it something more craft-oriented, more deep work. We allowed knowledge work to be much more ambiguous and hyperactive and back and forth communication. That's a type of work that I think is much more prone to huge shifts in our employment.
So how do we decrease our reliance on technology where we're spending so much of it, using so much of it to manage relationships virtually instead of just being productive?
Well, yes, now we can talk about the personal aspect of technology and things get a little bit trickier. And I think there's two elements to this. So one thing I've heard from companies during the remote work aspects of the pandemic are saying, yeah, there's this productivity hit from being on Slack all day or email all day, but as a side effect, we're getting more interaction with each other because we'd otherwise be isolated. And typically my response is separate those two goals. So we have the goal of actually, how do we collaborate? Let's find the most effective way to collaborate. And then we have this other goal, how do we foster connection and relationships while we're remote? Solve that problem separately and directly. What are we going to do as an organization to keep people feeling connected? Don't mix those two things together. Don't say we're going to be horribly unproductive so that we can be more connected. I'm sure we can find a way to be more connected and also be productive. And then, of course, we have the technologies in our personal life, social media, Zoom, FaceApp, WhatsApp. And it's all very important for connecting the people. We just have to deploy it carefully. We have to know why we're deploying it. I want to talk to my uncle on a regular basis. It's a great use of Zoom. But I'm going to use Twitter as a way to escape feelings of dread or just to numb myself is a bad use of technology. We have to start asking and answering those questions. What am I trying to do? How do I use these tools to accomplish it?
Is this going to be a flash in the pan, this idea that we're going to be able to work remotely? I mean, because you already see certain companies pulling very hard to try and get their employees to all come back to the building.
So my prediction is if your company does not revamp how you actually collaborate, right? We're going to revamp it so that it is more conducive for remote work, which means getting away from just this always on back and forth messaging. If you don't do that, almost certainly the friction will build up to the point where within 1 year, everyone will be back in the office. So I think that is where the gravitational force is right now. I mean, we're already seeing this at companies. We're seeing this, you know, Apple moving back to, we need you to be here 2 days a week or 3 days a week. We cannot change the way work happens just with memos, just with saying, here's our new rule for how we're going to work. You actually have to change the culture of work. So I don't know what's going to happen. Because to me, it all comes down to how many companies are going to be motivated enough to go through the pain of changing fundamentally how they work, to get away from the convenience of the hyperactive hive mind to something that's more structured and more effective. Those that do that will, I think, sustain large amounts of remote work. And those that don't, I don't think can. I just don't know how many are going to go through that pain right now. So it's going to be very interesting to observe over the next 2 years.
The book is called A World Without Email. Cal Newport, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're all going to be on that journey. And finally tonight, his death from an accidental overdose in 2016 shook the world and shocked his fans. But now the musical genius known as Prince is speaking to us again from beyond the grave. Well, it's a whole new album that's garnering great reviews since its release over the weekend. Recorded back in 2010, Welcome to America blends lyricism and cynicism as Prince takes on the issues of his time and our time. Racism, political corruption, division, disinformation. Here's a clip.
Welcome to America.
Everything takes forever. And truth is a new minority. Welcome to me.
Interestingly, the album was written during President Obama's first term, and Van Jones worked in the Obama White House, and later he became a close friend and advisor to Prince. So who better to talk to about all of this right now? Van Jones, welcome to the program. Van, I know you're super cool. We all do. How does a White House operative become best friend and advisor to one of the most legendary musicians of our time?
Well, he had a lot of best friends. I was happy to be in the mix. He honestly, he's part of the reason I wound up in the White House in the first place. He found out about the work we were doing in Oakland, teaching urban youth to put up solar panels, and he wound up funding all that work. And then that got me in the White House helping Obama with that stuff. And when I left the White House, Prince saved my life. I left the White House under fire. The right wing was coming after me, and I didn't know where to go. And Prince pulled me in and changed my life. And I never knew that this album existed, even though he must have been working on it while we were together. That's Prince.
Well, that's really an amazing. That's what amazing what you said. A, I didn't know that he had been so instructive in helping, you know, with those projects you had, and how closely he had helped you. But I want to ask you, you probably heard the little clip we played where he says, hope and change, everything takes forever. The truth is a new minority, or welcome to America. I'm going to ask you because, you know, some of the critics have said some of the words look like, you know, they reflect a little bit of a disillusion with the Obama administration. I know it was early in the administration, but what would your reaction to that be?
Well, I think that Prince wanted more from all humanity, not just the Obama administration. I think that makes it too small. I think that Prince was probably literally 30 or 40 years ahead of his time, and he had the pain and the frustration that comes with that. Don't forget, he and David Bowie were trying to put their music on the internet in the 1990s when people didn't even know what the internet was. I mean, he was already had in his mind a vision for what would now be called a Tidal or Spotify or streaming. It didn't exist. So he's living in this constant state of being literally decades ahead on race, decades ahead on gender, decades ahead on sexuality, decades ahead on democracy, decades ahead on everything. And so I wouldn't reduce it to something about the Obama administration. He just wanted humanity to be better than we've shown up as so far.
I want to play another clip, and it's Land of the Free, Home of the Slave. These are obviously also prophetic lyrics. And of course, he wrote this before so many of the names that we've come to memorialize, so many black men and women who've been unjustly killed. He wrote them before George Floyd and Trayvon Martin. Let's just play this.
Keep playing. It gets worse.
Oops, I mean, Land of the Free, Home of the Slave. It's pretty, it gets right into your solar plexus, that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole album is like that. I mean, again, he was so far ahead of the times that he could put out an album. Now, think about this. He created this album. It's perfect. I mean, every song is great. He's got the hooky stuff. He's got the sexy stuff. He's got the political stuff. And he just sticks it in a drawer, just never even releases it. And, you know, the vault is full of stuff like that. He could have put that out at the time and it would have made a big difference. But now it comes out 10 years later and it makes an even bigger difference. It hits even harder. That's the genius of Prince. People talk about Prince as a musical genius. That is too small. He had a genius for humanity, a genius for people that was so powerful that it could only be expressed musically. A lot of people can play a lot of instruments. There's only one Prince.
Let me ask you, because, you know, there's always lots of discussion about when somebody has died and then a huge piece of their work is put out. You don't know why, by who, well, at least maybe you all do. But do you have any ethical qualms about that? I mean, do you think he would have wanted it to come out? Did he want it to come out?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is Prince put the stuff in the vault for a reason. He didn't put it in the trash can. He didn't put it in the shredder. He put it in the vault. And he said himself that they'll still be going and pulling stuff out of the vault in 50 years. That's how much content there is. And look, some of it's unbelievably good. Some of it is not that good. But, this particular album, you can't argue this was ready to go. It could have been literally released as it was recorded and as it was put in the vault. So you can't argue he didn't ever want this to be heard. I mean, if you listen to it, the guy he's some kind of magic, because this album comes out the year it needs to come out, even though it's 5 years after he died.
Yeah, I know, it is incredible that. And we have one of his sound bites when he's talking to an MTV critic about the vault, the legendary vault. So just to expand on what you were saying, let's play this.
Some amazing jazz work. You'd find the best, most heady tracks that the Revolution recorded, the ones that we thought were too far gone back in the 80s. You'd find the more psychedelic rock version of the time. You'd find the really erotic Prince.
Really?
The really erotic sensual Prince. You'd find the future.
What are some of your personal reflections on yeah, well, that you were saying that. We don't know what else is going to come out. But when you listen to this and you remember your friendship, how do you think about the influence he had, but also would have kept having had his life not been cut short?
You know, I think about that every day. You know, what would he have thought about, Donald Trump as president? What would he have thought about? Don't forget, he's from Minneapolis, Minnesota. So you talk about George Floyd, that's all right there. You know, that whole thing happened right in his backyard. He would have been there. He'd have been doing something. I don't know if he'd have been marching in a protest. That wasn't really his thing. But he would have been involved. His voice would have been massively a part of this moment. You know, he was one of the first people to give significant money to Black Lives Matter when they first started and people didn't know what to make of them. He gave money to the Harlem Children's Zone, Jeffrey Canada. He helped Yes We Code get started. He helped Green for All get started. He was an unbelievable philanthropist, but he never wanted to be known. He thought it was important for the people who were doing the work to get the attention, not the people who were funding the work. He's very different in that regard than many of his peers. I tell you, I have no idea, but the world is a poorer place, a dumber place, and a less happy place because he's not here to help us through these times.
Van, I want to ask you a question because this has come out 10 to 11 years after he recorded it. And this summer, we've seen this amazing hidden treasure that's been made into this fabulous film, Summer of Soul, about the big concert in Harlem back then. And it's also the 50th anniversary of Martin Gaye's famous protest album, What's Going On. I guess I want to ask you specifically about those treasures, like Summer of Soul and this one of Prince. Do you think it would have made a difference in how people looked at your community had they come out earlier? Particularly, I just want to ask you about Summer of Soul right now.
Well, you know, it's hard to know because people look at the Black community in different ways at different times and from different angles. What I will say, hopefully this doesn't come out the wrong way, but there's a repository of genius and magic and resilience and insight and perspective in the Black community in the United States that is really second to none. That's why you got kids in Korea who are rapping, and that's why you've got blues and jazz restaurants and opportunities all around the world. There's just something about this crucible that we've gone through as a community trying to get America to live up to its best ideals in both its Constitution and its Bible that has created something. No pressure, no diamonds. We got a lot of diamonds in this community, and I think the more people look into who we are and what we're about, the richer the world gets, because we got a lot of riches here.
So let's listen to No Pressure, No Diamond. This is just a nice summer song from Prince, Hot Summer.
Anybody close enough to hear knows what we've been listening to all year. These are the days my people told me to fear. I think it's gonna be hot summer.
Hot summer, yeah.
Just wait and see. Hot summer. Shoo-wee-wee-wee. Hot summer.
As long as
you're my company.
I guess like every great genius is he could do any genre, couldn't he?
Any genre. It didn't matter what it was. He was music. He lived it. He thought it. Everything about him. He wrote almost every day. He performed literally every day. You know, he could do it all. I mean, a lot of the songs that we think about as belonging to other people, like, you know, Manic Monday and the Bangles, Prince wrote that too. He's an unbelievable person. But what I'll say is he cared a lot about people. He cared about people who didn't have much. He wasn't born with much. And so he was constantly on the internet, YouTube, trying to find people to help. And the music was a part of it. But he made his whole life into a contribution.
Really great insights and great to have this album. Van Jones, thank you for being with us. And that is it for now. You can always catch us online on our podcast and across social media. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.